$7 that bears the endorsement of MZ Grocery and was actually deposited into the MZ Grocery store account. The testimony at trial, Mr. Ferris testified that he did not cash that check, yet it was endorsed by his grocery store and was deposited into his grocery store's account. He testified at trial that he did not, positively did not. If you read the testimony that we've cited, he testified that he did not cash that check when it's clearly it shows the contrary to it. The whole premise of the plaintiff's case, the appellee's case, was that somehow there was this agreement between Couve and DeMasi to develop this restaurant, and then somehow jointly share the profits from that restaurant, when clearly the testimony at trial showed that Couve entered into a lease, and then they entered into a sublease with Mr. DeMasi, and Mr. DeMasi testified that he never had any intentions of sharing anything with Couve Partners in this particular matter. Further, if you read through the testimony, you'll understand that Mr. DeMasi ended up filing bankruptcy in September of 2007, and nowhere in the bankruptcy pleadings or any of the documents was there any reference to owning a partnership or owning some kind of joint venture with Couve Partners. In fact, Couve Partners had to go into the bankruptcy court and to try to get possession of the property back because they were paying rent to Nagai, the original owners of the property. They were continuing to pay the rent to Nagai during the course while the lease was held up in bankruptcy and nobody could do anything with the property.
When it went to the bankruptcy court, then did Couve request lifting of the stay so that they could foreclose on the sublease or the lease? Is that correct?
Yes. What occurred in the bankruptcy court is KNW, which is Mr. Ferris is a partner in that particular company. KNW attempted to buy the lease out of the bankruptcy proceedings.
Okay.
When the trustee said you can buy it, Couve had a claim in for approximately $175,000 for unpaid rent at that time, and told the trustee, yes, you can sell them, but we need to satisfy our claim against the bankruptcy estate. And the trustee at that point said, K&W, you can buy that if you want to pay that the $175,000 to Couve. Well, K&W declined, and that's when Couve came in and requested to buy the lease from the bankruptcy trustee. And the bankruptcy trustee said that they agreed to sell it to Couve because it significantly reduced the claims against the estate of Mr. DeMasi, the bankruptcy estate of Mr. DeMasi. Our argument is basically simply that there is legally or factually insufficient evidence to support virtually all of the conclusions that were reached in this case. It's difficult to argue this case. Justice Holman is a former member of this bench, and it is very difficult for me to sit up to stand in front of you and argue that quite basically that he was flatly wrong in coming to the conclusions that he did. And the reason, you just say, well, why request oral argument when all the facts and the law are set forth in the briefs of the parties? What I want to tell you is what you don't get when you read the transcript the first time, and what you don't see actually in the briefs. The trial occurred just as they were naming John Chupp to succeed on the 141st. There was a lot of conferences going on behind the scenes. Justice Holman was sitting in for the docket, managing the motions as well as the trial. The record is very thick, but the testimony is very thin. Why is it very thin? The trial started on March 31st, on a Tuesday. It started at 9:48. It was recessed at 10:47 to allow the plaintiff to renumber his exhibits. Then we restarted at 12:30. We recessed at 4:18. On Wednesday, we started at 12:56. Not in the morning. We started at 12:56, and we were off at 4:05. Thursday, 1 o'clock, off at 4:30. Friday, start at 1:30, off at 4:32. So you can see that the trial occurred piecemeal over 4 days, and many witnesses were taken out of turn, and so to get any kind of continuity was very difficult. It wasn't until April 10th that Justice Holman prepared and filed his findings of fact and conclusions of law, and those were not communicated to the parties until the final judgment was entered on April the 21st. The final judgment had an error in it in that it did not even mention foreclosure as had been requested by the plaintiff, and the plaintiff was required to file a motion to modify the judgment, which occurred, and the modified judgment was then filed on April 28th. When you read the transcript, there are several things that you need to focus on that are very important. Mr. Ferrez never, ever, at the time that he was doing the construction on the project, never asked Mr. Epstein or Mr. Hargrove for any payment. He never directed any invoices to Coov, Mr. Epstein, or Ferrez. It was only in February of 2008, when he filed his lien, 3 months after he had pulled off the project, that he asked for payment from our client. In the statement of facts in the appellee's brief, they make much ado about our client asking Mr. Ferrez to complete the construction for $50,000 and saying that they had this meeting to discuss the reopening of the restaurant. If you read the testimony, that meeting was a random meeting where Mr. Epstein, Mr. Hargrove, and another individual were eating at a restaurant when Mr. Ferrez wandered into the same restaurant. And Mr. Ferrez came over to say hello to him. And Mac Hargrove, if you read the testimony, Mr. Hargrove said, you know, Mr. Ferrez, what would it take you to complete the construction? If we paid you $50,000, would you complete the construction? Why? Because Coov is paying $15,000 per month to Mr. Nagai to keep this lease. They also have an option. If you read the lease, they have an option to purchase the building. They wanted to keep that option alive so that they had the opportunity to buy that building. That is why they're trying to keep this project going, why they're trying to maintain the lease and keep the continuity going. The December meeting was not an arranged meeting. It was not an arranged meeting where Mr. Ferrez was brought in to see if he would complete the construction. As I said, it was a random meeting. In the testimony also, and I've noted this in my brief, you know that when Mr. Ferrez was asked, did Coov and DeMasi hold themselves out as a partnership, Mr. Ferrez testified that he did not see that. He says, no, I did not see that. The timeline, the lease was entered into in May 7th. The construction occurred between June and November. Mr. DeMasi went into bankruptcy in September when Ferrez actually pulled off the construction in November, and the December was a random meeting. Of course, Mr. Epstein was trying to finish the project. He was trying, like I said, they were trying to salvage the underlying lease and their option to purchase the building. They have a $1.1 million option to purchase the building where the property is located. They talk about lost profits. There's no testimony in there that Coov ever expected to be paid from the profits of that restaurant. There is absolutely no evidence, no testimony in there, only inferences that you can draw from statements of fact. Coov and Mac Hargrove did testify that they lost profits. They did. They paid because they were paying every month. They were paying Mr. Nagai, the landlord, for the underlying lease. And when Mr. Epstein decided to take the project forward and finish the project themselves and open a restaurant themselves, which was never the original intent, it was only to salvage what they had already put into it. There was the maneuvering in the bankruptcy court to delay, and it was our contention at trial that the maneuvering by K&W was a deliberate attempt to delay the opening and to basically starve Coov out of the lease so that K&W, which had acquired two of the other restaurants from Mr. DeMasi out of the bankruptcy and were operating the same similar restaurants over in Arlington and Richardson, okay, it was their plan, it was our contention at trial that it was their plan to starve Coov out of that lease so that they could, in fact, open up a restaurant in that particular location.
Mr. Fitzgerald.
Yes.
If the ultimate goal of KUV was to end up owning the property.
Yes, sir.
By use of the option in the lease.
Yes, sir.
And if the lien for Ferris is not discharged in the bankruptcy court, didn't that lien follow the property and was ultimately going to be required to be paid by KUB in order to obtain the title?
Your Honor, the lien was incurred. When K&W bought the property, okay, they released the lien as to the landlord, as to the fee, and the lien was only then as to as to the leases. And it's our contention that the lien only extends to the leases. Okay, it only extends to.
Doesn't follow the lands, what you're saying.
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
K&W is Ferris Company.
Yes, K&W. K is for a gentleman named Kas Alamadi. N, it was our contention, N is for Nabil Damasi. It was our contention at the trial and Mr. Damasi's testimony that he, when things went south for him, he then started to work with Mr. Ferris and Mr. Alamadi to resurrect the project themselves. The company was formed. It was our contention that the N was for Nabil, the K was for Kas Alamadi, which Mr. Alamadi testified that is true, and that the KNW was for Weil, Mr. Ferris's first name, and Mr. Ferris confirmed that the W, and Mr. Alamadi confirmed that the W was in fact for their name. Yes, and that is an LLC that is owned by Mr. Alamadi and Mr. Ferris.
All right, Mr. Fitzgerald, thank you. Mr. Henry.
May it please the court, I'm Byron Henry. This is my co-counsel, Melinda Newman, and we together represent the appellee in this appeal, Ferris Construction. Before I make a couple notes about the evidence, I want to address a couple of the points that Mr. Fitzgerald made. First of all, with respect to the testimony on joint development, jointly developing the restaurant, I'd point out that in his conclusion, Mr. Fitzgerald implores this court to take an objective view of the evidence. Unfortunately for the KUV and the other appellants in this case, this court does not take an objective view of the evidence. As this court well knows, it views the evidence in a skewed fashion, and that is biased in favor of the judgment in the trial court's findings. And therefore, some of the testimony, such as Mr. Damasi's testimony, that he did not ever intend to be in a partnership can be disregarded by the trial court in favor of other testimony. Also, I would point out that in his brief, Mr. Fitzgerald pulls out all the evidence opposing the judgment in the statement of facts, and there is none of the evidence that's included in the appellee's brief with respect to the evidence that supports the trial court's judgment. I'd like to first go to the basic issue of quantum merit, and the two elements that are challenged in the brief are there is one sentence saying there's no evidence that Ferris was expected to be paid by Mr. Epstein and Mr. KUV, only Mr. Damasi. And I would simply say that with respect to expect for payment, I believe that the invoices, as we pointed out in our brief, were sent to the property address. That property address was both an address for KUV as the landlord and the sublessee. So with respect to inferences, the fact that some of the invoices were sent directly to Damasi, which appellees concede, numerous other invoices were sent not to Mr. Damasi, but directly to the property address for the project, Texas Palominos, which the trial court found was the project, and Mr. Fitzgerald concedes that the joint development, if there was one, was regard to the project, Texas Palominos, the restaurant. So I believe there is evidence in which this court and the trial court could infer that it's ambiguous as to who exactly they were expecting payment from in some instances. Obviously, when they send the invoice directly to Mr. Damasi, that is some evidence they're expecting payment from Mr. Damasi, though I would say that if there's evidence that it is a joint development, joint enterprise with respect to the project, the fact that one person would be designated as the person to receive the invoices is not dispositive of the issue as to whether or not all the parties involved in the enterprise would be expected to pay.
Well, I don't see how sending the invoices to the project at the address of the project gives us any clue as to who he's looking to pay.
I'm saying, Your Honor, it's not dispositive. Mr. Fitzgerald's statement was simply that the only person he ever looked for payment was Mr. DeMasi. And I'm saying if there is an inference, if it is ambiguous, that can be drawn from where the invoices were sent, certainly this court is free to draw the inference that Ferris was looking to the project itself, whether it be Mr. DeMasi, KUV, Mr. Epstein, and not just, in other words, it's not dispositive that he only directed it directly at Mr. DeMasi.
Okay.
And even if so, my point was the fact that someone is your point person on the site and you address the invoices to that person has to be considered in light of all the evidence, not just if he only looked to DeMasi, if it's a joint enterprise, that doesn't mean that it's only that would foreclose Quantum Merowith. I would
at
also
any point, let me ask you this. After DeMasi filed bankruptcy, were any additional invoices sent to someone else?
I don't remember the exact dates. I believe that all the invoices at that point in time were being sent to 4421, which was the address, the street address for the project itself, the property. But there were no addresses, there were no invoices sent directly to anyone else, though the meeting that was discussed, I'm not sure how the meeting itself, the randomness of it matters, but the content of the meeting was there was a negotiation about payment, there was a negotiation about completing the project, and as I pointed out in my brief, and I won't go through all the evidence because it's listed, but with respect to it being referred to as our restaurant, our project, and things of that nature, there was plenty of evidence in the record from which Justice Holman could have drawn the fact that this was one deal. I would also point out with respect to profits, the distinction that Mr. Fitzgerald made that the profits were because K&W was in the bankruptcy court delaying things is irrelevant. No one disputes that the sublease of Mr. DeMasi was not terminated until they came out of bankruptcy. Therefore, any profits from the restaurant that was lost would not belong to KUV. They cannot be entitled to profits from a restaurant that they admit they have no interest in. It doesn't matter how long they delayed. They're only a landlord. According to their theory, the evidence only supports a strict relationship of sublessor to sublessee. A landlord is not interested in the profits from the restaurant. They may be somewhat interested in the sublessee actually running a business so they can pay rent. That's understandable. But they are not entitled to sue and obtain profits from a restaurant operation. And that is, in fact, what happened in this case. They actually pled that by delaying things in the bankruptcy court, the members of K&W cost them, KUV, Mr. Epstein, and Mr. Hargrove, their profits from the restaurant. That's exactly what Justice Holman found in this case, that KUV and Mr. DeMasi agreed to jointly develop the restaurant project. And that makes sense if the two of the parties, Mr. Hargrove and Mr. Epstein, are testifying, Judge, we lost profits, a huge amount of profits, because this was stuck in bankruptcy. As a landlord, they would only be losing future lease payments from their future sublessee, not any profits. So we believe that that in itself is evidence of their interest in the project in the restaurant, among all the other evidence that we pointed out in our brief. I would also like to point out that the only case cited by the appellants in their brief, Gibson v. Bostic, is basically the prototypical absent owner, apartment complex owner, hail damage to a roof, property manager on site, or the lessor on site, has things done to the property, gets repairs made, and Gibson is basically an easy case to decide that the lien does not run to the land, as Justice Meyer asked. It doesn't attach to the fee estate because the property owner didn't contract for any of the services. In that case, it was an absentee property owner that didn't even know of the damage that the repairs were being made. So to the extent Gibson stands for the proposition that if you don't provide services for the owner and the owner doesn't know about it and they're gone, you can't attach to the fee, we do not dispute that. That's nothing like this case, as the evidence, as Mr. Epstein was not only on-site directing subcontractors on a regular basis, actually purchased and paid for materials, as we pointed out in our brief, changed a few of the specifications, not many. It's not like he controlled the project himself solely, but he certainly exerted control in numerous instances, including paying his own money, using his own name to guarantee utilities, his own Social Security number for the property to get the utilities turned on. And any one of these in isolation, it would be argued. I'm on the defense side of these cases often, and any of these in isolation, I agree, it could be argued in and of itself would not allow this court to affirm a judgment based on Quantum Merowith for providing services to KUV.
But when you look at the amount of evidence, the amount of control, the amount of testimony, and especially the seeking of the profits from the restaurant itself, I believe that with respect to the only two elements challenged, providing work for KUV and expecting to be paid by KUV, when they actually sat down and negotiated a price for past work and for, in fact, Mr. Ferris asked Mr. Epstein to pay him for the past work at that meeting. And at that point, Mr. Epstein was quick to point out, we're just a landlord. We have a very distinct relationship here. And, of course, the evidence up to that point did not show that they were just a landlord in any event. Moving on to the joint development issue, just a couple points about that. The only element in the brief, one paragraph that's challenged with respect to joint venture and joint enterprise is that of joint control. And I think I've already discussed a little bit of the evidence with respect to joint control, especially the profits and loss, even though it wasn't challenged specifically in the brief or there's no authority or briefing on that issue. Profits and loss was Mr. Hargrove testified himself that he had lost $70,000 on behalf of KUV, and of course they testified for lost profits. So that evidence alone, I believe, is enough for profits and loss, despite the fact that it wasn't challenged. One other thing with respect to the evidence that they provided the materials, which is actually the way it was challenged in the appellant's brief, they provided the materials for KUV. The lien affidavit, which was the sworn testimony of Mr. Ferris, it's at 8 Reporter's Record, Volume 8 of the Reporter's Record, Defendant's Exhibit 10. Actually, Mr. Ferris testified, we provided the labor and materials to KUV at the request of Mr. Epstein. That affidavit was entered into evidence without objection, and not only without objection, but in toto, meaning not for the limited purpose of showing notice. Therefore, that sworn testimony would be some evidence that materials, labor and materials, were provided to KUV, and in our opinion, disregarding contrary evidence, if a reasonable juror or fact finder could, we believe would support the finding that materials were provided to KUV. With respect to the different ways of liability, I just wanted to make it clear that we believe you can find a judgment directly against KUV for Quantum Merriwick for providing the materials. You only need to discuss or get into joint enterprise, jointly developing finding if you find that you cannot, there's no direct liability of KUV for the labor and materials. Then I believe you would have to talk about vicarious liability, whether or not they're liable for what Mr. DeMasi ordered for the project under a joint venture, joint enterprise theory. So therefore, we believe it's an either or. We believe the evidence supports both. And I do agree with Mr. Fitzgerald's point about the lien. Mechanics lien only rises as high as the person on the totem pole, of course, because we believe there's a direct judgment you can have against KUV under joint enterprise or under Quantum Merriwick. We believe that's as high as we're trying to get, is to KUV's interests and that their leasehold estate. And briefly on the there was something in the prayer of the appellant's brief with respect to remanding for attorney's fees in the event the court were to reverse the judgment. I didn't address that in my brief. In fact, I must admit I missed it on my first review. I would say that if you look at Clerk's Record 83 to 85, their pleading, and the Reporter's Record, I believe it is fourth volume, pages 82, somewhere in that range, there's testimony where Mr. Fitzgerald attempts to testify to his attorney's fees. And on cross, he did have a claim for Chapter 9 and 10 frivolous filing for attorney's fees, so it was appropriate for him to testify to attorney's fees. But when Mr. Mallers cross-examined on the grounds for the attorney's fees, the court sustained the objection that that attorney's fees under Chapter 53.156 of the property code had not been pled, and therefore it wouldn't be appropriate for this court to reverse and remand for the attorney's fees for the defendants in this case, even if the judgment was reversed, because that point has not been appealed here. In other words, there was no pleading claiming attorney's fees under Property Code 53 at the time the case was tried. I'll point out that a pleading was filed after that by the defendants, and it was filed, I think, on the last day of trial. It's at Clerk's Record 74. Of course, under Rule 63, there was no leave. It added a new claim for attorney's fees. This wasn't tried by consent, obviously, because Mr. Mallers objected to it, and it was sustained. So there wouldn't be any consent to add that after the trial or whatnot. So we would say that in the event, unlikely event, this court were to reverse,
the judgment in its entirety, there would be no need to remand the case for any recalculation of attorney's fees on behalf of the defendants. If the court has no other questions, we ask that the court affirm the judgment and affirm Justice Holman's findings and conclusions with respect to liability for the appellants in this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Henry. Mr. Fitzgerald, rebuttal.
Thank you. With respect to the attorney's fees, there was an amended answer that was filed, and it was filed prior to the start of testimony and the hearing on Friday, the last day, and Justice Holman did agree to accept the answer, and it was so the amended answer and counterclaim with respect to attorney's fees under 53 of the property code was properly before the court because the judge did accept the amended answer and counterclaim. KUV's address is 1503 El Dorado. It's on file with the Secretary of State, and all the documents that were admitted into trial indicate that. No invoices. With respect to the invoices after bankruptcy, yes, Mr. Ferris generated a bunch of invoices in November. Again, none of them were given to Mr. Epstein or Mr. Hargrove or directed to Coop. There was a plethora of invoices that were generated in November when the project went south. The profits that Mr. Hargrove testified to as to the restaurant were only with respect to February to June of 2008, okay, because it was then, as they were trying to save the lease and resurrect the property, it was our contention at trial that this was vexatious litigation in the bankruptcy court to stall, as I mentioned earlier, to stall us from completing the project, from completing construction and opening a different restaurant. With respect to construing the statement of the evidence in this case, I would direct the court's attention to Appley's briefs, their statement of facts. On page one, it says, early on, DeMasi began having money problems and engaged Epstein and Hargrove principals for assistance. That's a quote. They refer to volume four, Reporter's Record 15. Nowhere in the cited page is Mr. Hargrove ever mentioned. Further, the characterization that Mr. DeMasi engaged Mr. Epstein to find money is simply not there. He simply said, Moshe, I'm having money problems. This is when Moshe was pestering him for rent. On page two of their statement of facts, Epstein and Hargrove were regularly updated on the work necessary to complete construction, and Epstein gave instructions and modified work on the project. If you read their site volume two, Reporter's Record, pages 16 and 17, there is no testimony on the cited provisions that mentions Mr. Hargrove or that Mr. Epstein gave any instructions or modified the work. There was testimony at trial that Mr. Epstein directed where an electrical plug should be placed. On page two, conversations concerning reopening a finished work when Ferris, quote, threatened to stop work. As I mentioned, the December meeting was after Mr. Ferris had long left the project, and it was a random meeting. The volume they refer to is volume two, Reporter's Record 62. Testimony was that the conversation was a random meeting. This is the testimony. It was a random meeting at a different restaurant after Ferris had pulled off the project. Further, on page three, they mischaracterized, quote, we need to finish, close quote, and we need to help DeMasi. This is like it's a continuation of that December meeting, when in fact that discussion occurred in October of 2007 when Mr. DeMasi was starting to have financial problems, and they were trying to get people to assist Mr. DeMasi and work with him on getting his project completed. This was all before everyone knew of the bankruptcy. On page three, Epstein and Hargrove made a valiant effort to salvage the project because they were the only people who really paid any money towards the project. That's volume two, Reporter's Record 175, they referred to. Mr. Hargrove was out money paying the rent because he was paying $15,000 a month to Mr. Nagai. Mr. Epstein testified that he lost money because the restaurant wasn't open. Well, that's because he wasn't getting paid rent. Nobody was paying him rent. That's why he was losing money. He wasn't losing profits on the restaurant. He was losing money because they were paying $15,000 to Mr. Nagai every month. There's no testimony that Coove was ever to be paid profits from the restaurant when Mr. DeMasi was in control of that project. It was only in February when Epstein tried to save the lease and save the project that they were there was testimony with respect to profits. Now on page three, in their statement of facts, they say Couve signed the lease with Allot and accepted the interior improvements by Ferris as the deposit. That is incorrect. That is flatly wrong. I refer to Volume 2, Reporter's Record 179, questioned by Mr. Mallers, questioning Mr. Epstein. So, in lieu of the $35,000 in deposit, you just took the tenant improvements as a security deposit that you claim had to be done after Mr. Ferris quit. Is that correct? If that's what it says, that's what's written there. In fact, the security deposit, they're saying that that Allot and Couve accepted that as Mr. Ferris's work because they waived the security deposit with Allot, when in fact the security deposit was waived because they had to pay approximately $200,000 to finish out the construction on the restaurant. That's what was waived, not Mr. Ferris's work.
All right, Mr. Fitzgerald, can you make your conclusion, please?
In conclusion, what I think it's our we request the court to find that there is insufficient or legally insufficient evidence to support the conclusions, the findings of fact that were filed by Justice Holman. Not that we don't dispute that you can imply findings of fact. If there are other findings of fact that do support it, what our contention is that the findings of fact that are on file are not supported by the evidence or in either legally or factually sufficient. We would request the court to reverse the ruling of Justice Holman at the trial court level and remand this for a finding as to attorney's fees for the defendants.
All right. Thank-